Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
This episode of Intersection was originally taped on April 12, 2012. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Intersection, where people and ideas meet online and on KBIA. I'm Ruben Stern. Spring is officially upon us, and for many in the country, it arrived early this year. Temperatures in the lower 48 states in March were more than 8 degrees above normal. Here in Missouri, the average March temperature was the highest it's been since 1895. So what's going on? What's causing this unusual weather? And what effects are we likely to see around the state? Today, our expert guest will help us better understand this early spring. Later in the program, we'll hear from a farmer, a scientist, and an agricultural economist. But first, joining me in the studio to talk about the weather, Tony Lupo is the chair of the University of Missouri Department of Soil, Environmental, and Atmospheric Sciences. Welcome to our program, Tony Lupo.
Thank you. I'm glad to be with you today and talk about the weather.
Glad to have you with us. We also have on the phone Janice Stillman. She is the editor of the Old Farmer's Almanac, which has been forecasting the weather since 1792. Welcome, Janice Stillman, to our program.
Thank you. I just should say the almanac has been making the forecast for that long. I haven't been around quite that long.
I don't think any of us have, although I know a few people who might be close. I want to start off talking about, again, the weather and this early spring. Janice, maybe we'll start with you. Did you guys see this coming?
Well, we did predict, the winter forecast to be above normal in most of the country. So, in fact, my meteorologist, Michael Steinberg, has been making our forecast since 1995, told me just coincidentally about a week ago that we were one of the only major long-range predictors who did indeed forecast that temperatures across most of the nation would be above normal for winter, and most of the others were saying colder than normal winter.
And what about the spring thing? I mean, could anybody have seen that early warm period in March coming down the pike?
Well, it takes more than just a change of the wind to change the temperature, granted in a grand sweep of the country. You've got ocean temperatures to consider even as far away from you folks as the Pacific and the Atlantic. You know, there's a lot of things going on, and so that one aberration, if you will, in the month, while granted it was well above average and a record breaker, probably couldn't have been predicted by too many people.
Tony, your thoughts on how that happened or what we could or could not have been able to?
I would agree with our guest. It would be impossible to forecast something like that. Anytime you have a record-breaking event, you're not going to foresee that coming, at least in the long range. And I think that the reason that we had such a warm March, at least initially, looks like a perfect storm of a couple of events.
And what would that perfect storm of events be? I mean, how would you explain this?
Well, for example, during the wintertime, it was very warm, but it was also very dry across much of the Midwest. And, of course, we had a jet stream that was way far to the north and kept the cold air bottled up in Canada. And, of course, by the time March comes around, the sun is getting higher in the sky. We had a large-scale ridge park itself over the United States and give us the same kind of drought feedback processes that you get in a summertime situation. That's the way it looks, at least initially.
And how is that playing out? I mean, is it continuing to sit there and make an unusual pattern, or are things normaling out?
About the beginning of April, this broke down, and we're more into what we would call a normal pattern for the northern hemisphere and for this part of the country in general.
Right. Janice, what about your staff? I mean, in terms of explaining why this happened, do you have an explanation for how this came in that adds anything to what Tony said?
No, I would agree with him in terms of the jet stream and the various other factors. And there's really no simple explanation because there are so many moving parts in the sky and in the atmosphere in terms of the weather. And by that, again, I mean the ocean temps and the jet streams and the oscillations. And consider, for example, the warm winter that we had in most of the country, in fact, the no winter that some people would say. One of our consultants suggested that it was the volcanic explosion last May, that would be May 11 in Iceland, that sent ash way up into the atmosphere, and that affected the winds over the North Pole and caused them to essentially pour over Western Europe and Asia, parts of Asia there, and even touching Africa, instead of pouring down through Canada. So if that indeed was the case, you know, there are just so many things that are out of our control and can't be foreseen.
And how do you go about predicting these things? I mean, your publication has been doing this for quite some time. What is going on there that does enable you to foresee some things like the warm winter that you predicted?
Well, we predicted above normal temperatures, but they were well above the normal that we expected. So we didn't at the time consider, for example, volcano. But the fact is that we use at the Old Farmer's Almanac are really three scientific disciplines, and that's what distinguishes our forecast from just about everybody else's. We use solar science, and in particular the sunspots, which occur in cycles of 11 years or so on average. We use climatology, which is the study of prevailing conditions over time, and our meteorologist essentially looks at the climate for decades and even centuries and sees how the sunspot activity corresponds. Was there a lot? Was there a little? What pattern are we in now in the solar cycle? And then he considers meteorology, which is everything from cloud cover, land temp, ocean temps, all those various other factors, and makes his prediction on the long range.
All right. And Tony, how does that compare with what your colleagues in the world of climate science do?
Well, we do about the same thing. We look at the past and compare the statistics of what's happened before in different regimes and project that forward. We use meteorological prediction, and we also use the climate models and try to get a handle on what's going to happen ahead of time. The one thing that we don't use that they use is the solar cycles, and that's something that I think we got to get into our forecasts.
I'm so glad to hear you say that. I have to admit, I've been at the Old Farmer's Almanac since the year 2000, and I'm fascinated and impressed with the impact of everything I've learned. And I am no solar scientist, but I've read a lot and just seen the effects and the influence, and it really is remarkable. And I think Tony would agree that for centuries, scientists believed that the sun was a constant star, and have learned since that there is a quiver. The word escapes me now, but it is not constant. It does the amount of heat and energy that it gives off varies, and that can in fact influence our atmosphere and so our climate. And even in a minuscule fashion, it can make a big difference.
Okay, I have to remind everyone this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about the early spring, and with me in the studio is Tony Lupo, chair of the Department of Soil, Environmental, and Atmospheric Sciences at MU. On the phone we have Janice Stillman, editor of the Old Farmer's Almanac. Later in the program we'll hear from three other guests about how the early spring might affect farming and wildlife in Missouri, so stick around for that. But in the meantime, back to the weather. Janice, you just mentioned something that is I'd never heard of. The sun gets warmer and cooler. Is that right?
Well, the sunspot activity, as I mentioned briefly, occurs in 11 years on average. And there can be more in the sunspots can occur in greater numbers, in greater frequency, and greater size in the course of a cycle. And that's what our folks, our solar scientists, even look at. And historically, the more and larger and more frequent sunspots, the warmer the conditions on Earth, and the fewer sunspots, and so the cycle is less. It's like a stock market ticker, if you will, only lately it's been going more or less down. So in periods of high activity, we've had corresponding warmer conditions on Earth. In low activity in the sunspots, we have corresponding, more or less, cool periods on Earth. Now, it's not the events we saw in March, or the temperatures in March, are not an immediate result of sunspot activity. It's a much larger, bigger picture, like I say, decadal kind of influence. And in fact, we had a story in the 2009 Old Farmer's Almanac where we had a color timeline going back about 105 years, that would be to the late 1800s, and displayed the trends then, and the headlines which was only in print, of course, at the time, range from things like Ice Age coming to We'll All Fry Now to, you know, Beware the Cold Spell over periods of 25 to 30 years. So there have been patterns in the fairly recent past where we've seen hot and cold and hot and cold. The one unavailable factor up until recently has been the immeasurable factor has been the greenhouse gases. We have never had greenhouse gases in the atmosphere such as we have them now. So the that could affect the general premise of what will happen under a given sunspot condition.
Interesting. And is that getting factored into the predictions that are being made by the Old Farmer's Almanac?
Indeed it is, yes.
Interesting. Interesting. Tony, you've studied a lot of climate science. I mean, what are you seeing patterns changing over time in terms of the weather?
Indeed. I mean, you look at the temperatures from the late 1800s to about 1940, things warmed considerably. You had a little bit of a cooling from the 40s to the 70s, and then starting from about 1977 to 2000, it warmed again. And, of course, the sun is one factor, as we're talking about here, but there are other factors as well, the oceans, other kinds of internal forcings, volcanoes, all these things play a role in the in what climate's going to do.
Right. So are we likely to see more early springs in the coming years or warm summers, things like that?
Well, the Old Farmer's Almanac, in fact, we're predicting a spring and summer will be cooler than normal in most of the country and indeed certainly in your region in the central U.S. So our larger prediction, and we've been saying this actually for several years now, is that the continued low level of sunspot activity that we just talked about in the current solar cycle 24 reinforces our belief that we're in the midst of a period of change whereby we will see cooler than normal temperatures in general for the next coming decade or longer, possibly offset by any warming caused by increased greenhouse gases.
Hmm.
So, you know, the winter was warm, yes, but the next several seasons, again, on a grander scale, could be much cooler than normal.
And does that fit with what you've, what you're seeing, Tony?
This fits with the current trend. Temperatures have been ebbing downward since about the mid-2000s, and solar activity is at least part of that equation. And, of course, the predictions for summer are kind of in agreement with things that we've been saying as well. We've been saying that if La Nina conditions start to emerge or actually, if La Nina dies and we start moving toward El Nino, that would tend to lead to a cooler summer in this part of the world.
Right. And, Tony, what about the rainfall that might be involved in the summer as well? Do you have any ideas what that's going to look like this year?
Yeah, generally when we transition from the La Nina state back toward El Nino, we notice that in this part of the country, the rainfall is closer to normal.
Right. Interesting, interesting. In terms of some of these other weather phenomena that we hear about, I mean, you mentioned La Nina and El Nino and things like that. How powerful are those, and is that getting more and more prevalent for those kind of global trends to be playing out here?
Well, for many years, people thought that year-to-year variations were just random occurrences in the climate, but we're now discovering that El Nino and La Nina are the dominant players when it comes to variations on the time scale of 2 years, 4 years, 6 years, that kind of thing. So knowing the phase of El Nino and La Nina and when they transition is certainly important, and science is starting to gain an upper hand on understanding these.
Interesting. And how accurate are predictions generally? Janice, maybe you could help us with that. How much can we trust the kinds of things that we're hearing right here on this program?
Well, from the Old Farmer's Almanac, you can trust us with a traditionally 80% accurate weather forecast. And to be sure, sometimes we have much more successful years. For example, the winter this past year, that would be in 2010 to 2011, the past winter, our temperature and precipitation forecast was 90.6% accurate. So we did very well last winter, not this immediate past one, which we haven't got the results on, but a year ago. And prior to that, we were about 80% accurate in our weather forecast. So we've had a couple of actually fairly good years. One thing to remember, and I think a lot of your listeners probably know, that the Old Farmer's Almanac, we do not tell you exactly what the temperature will be, nor what how much rain or snow will fall. We will give you the deviation from the normal. And so we'll tell you how much the temperature will deviate from the norm, or the, how much rain will or snowfall will deviate from the norm in inches, for example. And as Tony knows, too, that normal is a 30-year rolling period that, based on the latest data, would be 1981 to 2010. However, when it was available to us for the 2012 almanac, it was 1971 to 2000. That's a 30-year period that meteorologists around the world have agreed on. So it's not, for example, when you were knee-high to a grasshopper or anything like that. It's a relatively controlled period.
And does that period shift as time goes by, or is that a set period until everyone agrees on another set period?
It's a set 30-year period that rolls forward every 10 mm-hmm. years, and everybody, that is every major meteorologist in the developed world, has agreed on that.
And so is that, just help me understand this, so every 10 years normal changes?
The period of time on which the normal is based changes. So, for example, most recently it was 1971 to 2000.
Mm-hmm.
In the year 2011, it bumped to 1981 to 2010. But for us at the Old Farmer's Almanac, the stats weren't in, the math wasn't done, it wasn't calculated, so we used the old numbers for 1 year, and now next year we'll bump into our weather forecast for the 2013 almanac will reflect the normals from 1981 to 2010.
Right. And just, Tony, help me out here. Has it happened where, you know, when they shifted the period for the normal, that the numbers that are the normal numbers shifted significantly?
Oh, they do. And in the last period of time from 1971 to 2000 versus 81 to 2010, for example, the temperature shifted upward in our region by about 0.4 of a degree, which is not too bad. Although we're still a little cooler at this point than we were in the 1931 to 1960 period. So this part of the country, we're still not as warm as we were in during that period of time.
Interesting. Okay, I've got to remind everyone again that this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about the early spring in Missouri and across the country. I'd like to thank our guests, Tony Lupo, Chair of the Department of Soil, Environmental, and Atmospheric Sciences here at the University of Missouri, and Janice Stillman, who was on the phone with us, editor of the Old Farmer's Almanac. I'd like to thank you both for joining us today on the program.
Can I just leave you with a parting thought? And while all the data and statistics and whys are fascinating about the weather and why weather happens and what the outcome is going to be, here at the Old Farmer's Almanac, we also like to think that no matter what the weather is, the only perfect climate is in bed.
Okay, and with that, thanks again to our guests, Tony Lupo, Chair of the Department of Soil, Environmental, and Atmospheric Sciences at MU, and Janice Stillman, editor of the Old Farmer's Almanac, who's been joining us by phone. We're going to switch gears a bit and bring in a few other guests to talk about how the early spring might affect what's going on outdoors. Rob Lawrence is a forest entomologist with the Missouri Department of Conservation. Welcome, Rob Lawrence.
Thank you. Thanks for having me here.
Thanks for joining our program today. We also have in the studio Michael Monson. He is the chair of MU's Department of Agricultural and Applied Economics. Welcome to the program, Mike Monson.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Glad to have you with us as well. On the phone, we have Lowell Shostak. He's a farmer in northwest Missouri who grows corn, soybeans, and wheat on his farm. Welcome, Lowell Shostak.
Glad to be here.
Glad to have you with us as well. Now, Lowell, you've gone ahead and started planting your crops early, right?
Yes.
And could you tell us why you did that?
Well, the earlier you can get corn planted up, normally you'll have better yields. It has a better dry down, and it pollinates earlier, so you don't have quite the problem with the heat. The corn now should pollinate by the 4th of July, or maybe even a little bit earlier than that.
Mm-hmm. And are most farmers doing that?
By and large, we planted, a couple farmers planted earlier than, like, we planted in March, and actually the corn was up in March. And on the crop insurance, April 5th, is the earliest that they'll pay for a replant. Now, the crop is covered as far as the crop comes up. If you have to replant, you'd have to do it on your own.
Okay.
That's why a lot of people held back on planting maybe until April 5th, but there's a lot of people who planted before that date also.
Mm-hmm. Now, Michael Monson, you sort of studied the economics of this. So if all the farmers are planting all the way back in March, what are the implications down the road of that?
Well, you know, it's a long ways between planting time and harvest. We've got, you know, we've got rainfall issues, weather issues. You know, it's not just time with crop growth. It's heat units or growing degree days. It has to accumulate over a time period. So, you know, we still have a long ways to go on this. But anytime, you know, we get the corn in, get it up, he's absolutely right. That's what all the, you know, indicators are. The sooner you get started, the better your chances for a yield. Great to be looking ahead and avoiding that hot, dry weather for pollination if we can get that to happen earlier. Mm-hmm. Those are all things that are going to enhance their corn yields.
And how much more yield might people be able to expect as farmers because of this kind of a weather pattern?
Well, we jokingly say the models indicate the earlier the better, but you don't see a lot of corn planted on the 1st of January. So, you know, there are elements of risk associated with that. But this would be... You know, this is pushing the far end. Clearly, with the crop insurance cutoff date, that is that April 5th would probably be the maximum time for yield.
Now, there's a reason that date would be a crop insurance date, right?
We have frost issues, frost free dates, probabilities of having to replant because of weather conditions and things. So they basically have established that if you plant before then, we will not cover, or the crop insurance program will not cover the cost of replanting your crop.
Mm-hmm. And are the crops still in danger at this point, or
they're in danger. They're in danger all the way to market.
Fair enough. Yeah. But in terms of having been planted early and trying to take advantage of that, is there sort of a higher than normal risk out there at this point?
Well, I'd have to defer to your previous guests on that, and they're more expert about the weather patterns. But it's the frost would be the big concern right now, and I think it looks like we're going to be okay. I'm looking at the forecast, so
interesting,
a killing frost, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Rob, what are some of the other things that are happening early because of this warm spell out there in the wilderness?
Well, of course, with this warming weather this early, a lot of the plants, of course, are becoming more active in a sense. The insects are becoming more active and those kinds of things. We're getting leaf out, bud break on plants a lot earlier, blooming a lot earlier. We look at the timing of these things, the phenology of when the different bud break and bloom events occur on different species of plants. And by about the first week of April, we were already about 4 weeks ahead of normal. And now, over the last week or so, we've had this cool weather. And so we're estimating that we may be somewhere around 3 weeks ahead of normal. So we're starting to drop back. And the closer we get to normal, the better it is. Because if you'll recall, back in 2007, we had a really early warm-up. And then we had a sharp freeze first week of April for two or three nights, a real severe freeze down in the mid-20s. And so that caused a lot of damage to a lot of plants. And we've been seeing some of the effects on trees, for example, ever since then. Some of the trees that got damaged, some severe damage that's kind of carried over, continuing problems since then.
Interesting. So now all these years later, the trees are still recovering.
Right, because they got the shoot tips, the branch tips were killed, and there was probably some internal damage that we couldn't really see. We saw that the new shoots were killed and so forth, but there was probably additional damage that wasn't real visible. And we've been seeing some decline problems, stress problems with trees and shrubs. So these kinds of things, if they're severe enough, they can linger on. But hopefully we're kind of working our way out of that with this cool weather and kind of evening things out a little bit.
And does the cool weather slow the plants back down? I mean, to the point where, you know, they might realign with what would be normal growth?
Well, it's hard to say with this year. We were so far ahead that I don't know that we'll eventually, once we get past, like we were talking about, the frost-free dates, when we get past that, we can kind of breathe a sigh of relief. But a lot of these events are occurring that much earlier. Various insects are out earlier, and so it all plays with the weather as far as what causes these things, what triggers them, and then the possible impacts we can see from damage if we get freezes.
Mm-hmm. Lowell, are you seeing any kind of insects out earlier or those sorts of things that normally wouldn't be going on yet?
Not really. A couple of weeks ago, our cows had flies on them just like it was the middle of July, and then it cooled off, and so they're not there now. But I think and other people know this better than I think they're probably watching for cutworms because they're probably going to be earlier this year than normal. But other than that, it's been a really good growing. I mean, the grass is fantastic this time, and one thing is, interesting, cows aren't eating any mineral. Normally, turn in their spring, they really go through the mineral mixture. They really aren't eating as much mineral as normal, and everybody kind of says the same thing.
Right. Let me ask our insect expert about that fly thing. So, did the flies come alive and then die, and they're going to be reborn, or do they go dormant, or what's the deal with the flies that came up in a short period of time there?
Well, it's like with all insects, they go through this overwintering where they go through sort of a type of hibernation called diapause, and they go through that, and then when the temperatures are right, we get enough heating units, enough degree days in the spring, then the different insects will start coming out. They vary in their life cycles and timing, but just watching what's come out, the different species of insects that we've been seeing, they're coming out in what the expected sequence in relation to the various plant sequence events, the blooming of various trees and so forth. So it's all kind of going in succession as you would expect. It's just a lot earlier.
Okay. This is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about the effects of an early spring. Joining me in the studio are Rob Lawrence, a forest entomologist with the Missouri Department of Conservation, Michael Monson, the chair of MU's Department of Agricultural and Applied Economics, and on the phone we have Lowell Shostak, a farmer in northeast Missouri. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a few minutes, so stick around and we'll keep going with this conversation.
This episode of Intersection was originally taped on April 12, 2012. Thanks for listening.
This is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about the effects of an early spring. Joining me in the studio are Rob Lawrence, a forest entomologist with the Missouri Department of Conservation, Michael Monson, the chair of MU's Department of Agricultural and Applied Economics, and on the phone, Lowell Shostak, a farmer in northeast Missouri. Before the break, we were talking a little bit about the life cycle of the insects. Where are we with that? It's ahead of schedule, and so what's coming out now? What's coming out early? What are we going to see pest-wise before we expect to?
Well, one thing that we are seeing, you may be familiar with tent caterpillars. Those are the ones that make that silken webbing that you see in the forks of small trees like black cherry and so forth. You see along the roadside, you'll find a lot of those. We're seeing huge populations of that tent caterpillar, and actually it's the eastern tent caterpillar, and there's another one very closely related called the forest tent caterpillar, and it's also out in large numbers. And the thing about those particular ones that's kind of interesting is that they overwinter on the branches of trees. They spend the winter as eggs attached to the branches, so they're in a very exposed position. So in a severe winter, although they're adapted to survive cold winters, you might expect that they have a little higher mortality in a cold winter. But in this mild winter, you could see how that would benefit them being in that exposed location. And we're seeing really large numbers of those, especially in southern and eastern Missouri. And so they were out early, and they're getting near the end of that larval period when they do a lot of the feeding, and they'll be gone for the year soon. But then there are other insects, too, that we can just expect that they're kind of be out earlier than normal. We may see Japanese beetles earlier than normal and various ones this spring.
Right. And what sort of implications of that are there? Are there crop insects that are going to affect these early plantings that we've talked about, or other ones that are just sort of garden pests that are going to annoy people in a way that they might not otherwise?
Well, it's tough to predict sometimes, but if you think about how it all works, sometimes if the plants are responding not only to temperature but day length and the timing of when they come out, they may not be in sequence or in synchrony with when the insects are out. Perhaps the insects are out a little early. If they're out early, they might do more damage to a young plant that's just getting started. On the other hand, if the insects are out very much earlier, their particular host plant might not be available. There might not be leaves on a tree or something, for example. So they might starve and have poor survival. So it kind of depends on that synchrony. Right. And so you have to look at the specific insect and plant.
So the corn that was planted early this year, for example, might get ahead of the insects that might otherwise be an issue?
Perhaps. But it's so hard to predict this year. Everything is on such a freight train of being so early that it could go either way.
Right. Mike, do you have a sense of how farmers respond to something like this where, you know, that synchronicity of plant life and animal life might get thrown off a little bit because of the weather?
Well, our earlier conversation about, you know, getting the corn in and avoiding that heat for pollination that typically 4th of July or the July pollination, mm-hmm. if that can happen a week or so earlier when hopefully temperatures are cooler is one advantage, with the early planting. Mm-hmm. Again, it's just this opportunity, make hay while the sun shines, if you will, I think is the statement. But I've pulled some numbers here, and typically in the first 4 weeks of April, farmers can expect about 11 days to be in the field. And my guess is it's the 12th of April, and we've probably had that already this year.
Right.
So give you that idea. We talked about how much corn is in. Last year at this time, the National Agricultural Statistics Service monitors this for crops across the country, and for Missouri, last year we had 8% of the corn in on April 8th, and this year we've got 23% of the corn in on April 8th. So, and the average is about 6%.
So we're way above average for being ahead
for the state. Yeah, and for the country, 3% last year, 7% this year,
right.
And an average of 2. So it's not just the state. The corn's going in the ground right. Everywhere.
Now, is corn the first crop to go in the ground?
In Missouri, yes, and we have some winter wheat that was planted last fall that folks are evaluating, and instead of planting, they're looking at the conditions on that. Texas winter wheat crop isn't very good. They're anticipating there'll be folks who will tear that up and then replant with, try and take advantage of the corn prices and maybe plant corn where the winter wheat was.
Interesting. And what comes next? I mean, are all the other crops going to go in the ground early because of this?
Well, soybeans will be the next one, for our that we'll be planting, and soybeans are day length sensitive, and so that's I'm not quite sure that there's as much to be gained with an early planting on the soybeans apart from the convenience factor and getting your work done.
Right. So it's more about the hours of sunlight, yes. As opposed to the
right.
temperatures.
Right.
Interesting. And are there other crops that might have something to gain or lose as a result of this? I mean, like potentially sensitive fruit crops or things like that?
Well, you know, Missouri peaches, you know, notorious. We don't get whether we get a crop or not, you know, just let those peaches bloom and we'll get a frost, you know. It just seems like, you know, that's always a challenge. I'm sure folks have been out covering plants the last two nights, you know, their garden plants and things around here because of the freeze and frost warnings.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And in terms of the outcome of this, I mean, by the end of the growing season, in an early season like this, are there benefits that come at that point in the process in terms of being able to harvest early, or is that?
Well, as Lowell alluded to, the corn will dry down, which will save energy costs in terms of having to dry it down to a suitable moisture level for storage. So there's some potential savings there that, you know, the corn will be hopefully drier at harvest time and, save that energy cost.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Lowell, you know, you're working on the farm there. Are you going to be planting any of your other stuff early, or just the corn is in the ground and you'll wait on the rest of it?
Well, it's calling for rain this weekend, but hopefully we'll get a little bit. And I imagine we'll probably start planting soybeans, whenever the ground is dry enough. We found it's kind of used to think they kind of weighs on soybeans, but if they're treated, some people say they get along better getting those up than you do corn, as long as the soybeans are treated.
Right. And Lowell, you're not worried about the early frost or the potential for that?
Well, I mean, we're I guess not, because I think that's the 20th is a crop insurance deal on soybeans, and so if the ground, we don't no-till, we basically minimum till, but if they would be killed, you just go replant, you just kind of no-till them back in. So, I mean, the potential gain is a lot more than the loss. And of course, crop insurance has changed everything, you know, in agriculture. That's basically what drives a lot of decisions being made now, which wasn't 20 years ago. So you plant when you have an opportunity, and chances are percentage wise you're a lot better off planting, because again, we've had it before, it can get wet on you. It doesn't, just because it's dry now doesn't mean it's going to be dry, you know, that you can just plant whenever you want to. So you kind of use the opportunities you have available. Of course, if it's this early, you don't push it like you would if it's the, you know, first of June or something like that. But you still take opportunities to keep, and you know, that way your machinery, if something breaks down, it's not like it's and it always does. It doesn't crowd you like if you have to do it real very quickly.
Right. Right. Mike, maybe you can help us understand some of the other variables that are at play here. We've talked about the weather. We've talked about the length of the day involved. Are there other things that are, you know, not necessarily related to the warm spring that might affect what's going on the farms and the output at the end?
Well, clearly what's driving the corn and corn planting right now is the market price on corn. And that just the perceived profitability there. Corn is the crop we're going to set, or come close to setting, records for corn acreage planted in the United States. The market prices out there, the relationship of corn to soybeans, the price of corn is high relative to the price of soybeans. So there's farmers want to plant corn instead of beans. Mm-hmm. So when we can get our corn planted, plant it early. That's what the market's telling us to do. So we've got some concerns about the soybean harvest coming out of South America that perhaps may push the soybean price back up there to where they're more in line with what we traditionally expect those two prices to be. But you know, Lowell's doing exactly what the market is telling them to do, and that's plant corn.
Right. And are we likely to see any kind of effects on the price of stuff as a result of all these farmers getting corn in the ground early?
Well, the demand has been – worldwide demand has been so strong. Corn – as a livestock feed, income levels, that that we'll, I think that we'll be able to handle a good crop, and still, you know, forecast prices are still extremely, extremely good.
And so what does that mean in terms of being extremely good?
Well, right now, I think that the last time I checked, the December corn futures were $5.50 a bushel. And you don't have to go back very many years when we were, you know, half that.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Wow. And so even if there's a, you know, sort of a bumper crop of corn this year, that price is likely to hold?
If I knew that for sure, that would be another issue. But
I suppose you'd be on Wall Street or something,
right,
if you had that info.
But that's what the markets are telling us. So, yeah, I mean, because this 96 million acre corn crop is built into that. That's the forecast model. That's what everybody says. And even with that many acres planted, we're still talking about 550 futures price
right.
on corn.
And do you have a sense of how insurers are responding to this, the people who write that crop insurance that are seeing all these farmers plant in that saw them in March? And
crop insurance is a sensitive issue right now. It's in terms of government direct cost to the government, it's about a $6 or $7 billion cost that the federal government basically subsidizes the cost of crop insurance.
Interesting.
It's about the only remaining program. You know, the prices are so high that farmers aren't getting government payments for low prices. So in terms of what we typically were expending, that $6 or $7 billion is much less than government program payments have been in the past. But it's the only thing that's got a big target on it in terms of trying to save government payments to farmers.
Mm-hmm. But in this case, it's allowing the farmers basically the security to know that they can plant
exactly,
early.
Exactly. You know, for all intents, you know, we've substituted that for the old market price guarantees and loan rate programs and things that. So you know, it's been a trade-off, and probably if you look at things, it's probably costing less than our old programs used to.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. What about Rob? I want to bring you back into the conversation, Rob. What about this intersection of sort of the plant life and the animal life that contributes to farming and to the rest of the world? What about the bee population? They're kind of bees are instrumental in the agricultural world, right? Are they going to be affected by this weather change this year?
Well, one thing about honeybees, they go through the winter feeding on the honey, the pollen and so forth that they've stored in the hives, and when if you have a milder winter, then you may use up a lot of those reserves. And if you come out early, again, depending on that synchronization of, you know, whether there's enough blooming things. Right now, it seems like there's plenty, but with the pollen in the air, it certainly seems like plenty. but we've been seeing a lot of problems over the years with reductions in honeybee populations. There's that colony collapse disorder that we've been seeing, and various mite problems with honeybees. So they've had a lot of problems over the years. But you know, hopefully, you know, things are going to level out here.
Right. And are there attempts to manage that or to help boost the populations of insects like that?
Yeah, there's a lot of research going on trying to understand what that colony collapse is all about. And there's a lot of speculation and a lot of data being collected, and there's various culprits that are being looked at, but it's an ongoing process.
Right. And are there ways in which early presence of certain insects might be a good thing?
Well, if you think about all these effects of temperature on insects, of course, we kind of tend to focus on the pests. You know, are there going to be more pests? But if you think about it, those same conditions are affecting the beneficial insects. So the predatory insects, the parasitic insects that attack the pest insects, they're also being affected. If the weather is beneficial, we may have more of some of these other things. So that can be a good thing to see more of that. So that's one reason it makes it really hard to predict. People ask us, well, we had this early spring, mild winter, are we going to see a lot of insects? Well, it's also benefiting the natural enemies, for one thing. And then if you look, too, at what's going to happen from here on, it makes it kind of hard to predict. If we have a wet spring, if we have a cool, wet spring after this and we get a lot of rain, of course, that's beneficial to fungi. And if you get fungal pathogens, fungal diseases building up that attack insects, there's a lot of those that specialize on insects So if the fungal diseases build up, then that would reduce some of the insect population. So there's a lot of moving pieces out there, makes it difficult to predict.
Right. Lowell, are you concerned about that, either the presence or lack of insects that need to be there, or more sort of potentially problematic, the fungal type situations if the rain comes?
Oh, not really the way. I mean, we anymore, a lot of those decisions are made by the we kind of deal with the local co-op, and they kind of know kind of what's going on. And, you know, corn and soybeans are pretty tough crop. It's not like your, you know, vegetables and, you know, fruit, things like that are a lot more, require more management for this day and age. It's not quite like it was. Good, bad, or different stuff that we're planting now, like triple stack, things like that are a lot more hardy and adaptive things. Of course, there's debate over whether that's good, bad, or indifferent. We don't have any choice right now to plant that way. I guess you do, but that's probably about the only thing that's out there that's, that gives you quite a bit of flexibility. And your herbicides that you use now, there's just a lot of things now that it's, in a way, it's easier than it was, say, 30 years ago when wet weather were a lot more problem with what they are today. So I guess, personally, I'm not that concerned about that. Maybe should be, but I'm not.
Okay. Let me remind everyone again, this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today we're talking about the effects of the early spring that hit Missouri and most of the rest of the country. Joining me in the studio are Rob Lawrence, a forest entomologist with the Missouri Department of Conservation, and Michael Monson, the chair of MU's Department of Agricultural and Applied Economics. On the phone also we have Lowell Shostak, a farmer in northeast Missouri. We've been talking a lot about the agricultural part of this in terms of the plant farming, and I wonder, Mike, if you could talk about whether there are any implications for the livestock farming that goes on in the state.
Well, we could ask Lowell that traditionally, in the spring, the beef cows always look for the worst possible day to lay down and have their calves, and so they've been maybe had a hard time this year finding a bad day to do that. But, you'd have to think with this good weather, the survivability of those spring calves, spring lambs has been better than we would expect. You can look at feed conversion in the hog and the poultry industry. The temperature, the milder temperatures promote better growth there.
What does that mean, feed conversion, for those of us unfamiliar with farming?
They put on weight faster, if you will, or the same amount of feed will produce more weight gain than it would if they were fighting hot weather or extremely cold weather. Obviously, in the cold weather, so much of the energy they consume has to go to maintain body temperature. Mm-hmm. And instead, if we have milder conditions, they can convert that to ultimately to the meat that we're paying for. And then again, in extreme hot weather, the animals have a tendency to, shall we say, get lazy, and they don't eat as much and therefore don't gain as fast. So these should be near ideal growth conditions. Talk about that pasture out there. I think there's probably pasture or hay out there that could be harvested this early if we had the right set of conditions to do that. The growth on these pastures just appears to me to be phenomenal.
Interesting. And when would hay normally be harvested?
After Memorial Day, certainly, would be the typical indication there, mostly through the summer, because we do need the dry enough conditions for it to cure so that it can be baled and stored.
Mm-hmm. And so just take us down the line a little bit. So if the animals are getting bigger off of the same or less amount of food, how does that play out economically down the line? I mean, are farmers going to make more profits? Are people going to pay less for meat down the line, or all of the above? How does that play out?
Well, I mean, that would be the dream. The dream situation would be for the farmers to make more money and people pay less for the food. But unfortunately, those two things usually don't go together. But this would be an opportunity where we can produce the same amount of meat or the same products for a lower cost, and that should mean lower food prices. Beef supplies are tight right now. These conditions are certainly going to help the growth factors there. The bad news is that so much of our meat production is tied to feeding corn and the price of corn, and that's going to continue to be a significant expense.
Mm-hmm. So, and even though the amount of corn likely to come out is high, the price is still up.
Yes.
Interesting. Yeah. Interesting. What about other types of animal life in the state? I mean, Rob, I know it's not your specialty area, but do you have a sense of what kind of wildlife implications we might see?
Yes. You know, talking to some of the wildlife biologists in our department about this, and of course, they say that for deer, for example, a mild winter like this, that you have better survivability, and it's easier on them. They probably go into the spring a lot healthier, which will then help in reproduction and so forth. So, you know, it's beneficial to deer. For turkeys, the early spring. It may not have a whole lot effect on turkeys, although from our turkey biologist, he was telling me that a lot of the activity there in the spring and the mating and so forth is kind of determined by day length. So temperature may not have as much of an effect. But if you look at, for example, both turkey and deer. Feed on acorns, feed on that hard mass, those kinds of seed crops. And if we have a hard freeze that comes too early, it can damage the acorn crop. So that can affect it. So I don't think we've had that this year that would affect the acorn crop. But that is a concern that we watch sometimes.
Right. And if the plants start going early, I mean, we're back on plants here, but if they start going earlier in the year, what happens at the end of the season? I mean, do they just keep going throughout the season, or do they wind up sort of ending their growth cycle early as well?
Well, it depends on the kind of plant. Some plants have this indeterminate growth, and they will keep growing. Others have the determinate and so forth that they will have sort of an end, but I guess what really drives a lot of it is our weather later in the summer. We get into a dry, hot period. We get into a real drought. Things can shut down early. And I think for the end point, a lot of it is more about the dryness, the heat and drought that affects a lot of things. It sort of shuts them down early. And then, of course, if we get into an early kind of a fall, then it kind of wraps up early. But this early spring seems to have more of an impact on the front end. And then we get some really serious droughts in Missouri, of course, as you know. And so that's what we kind of watch for, what's going to happen later.
Mm-hmm. Are there other ways that the early spring is sort of playing out, other effects that we haven't talked about yet? I mean, things like, are people buying lawnmowers earlier? Are they, is there a rush for other things like that that are kind of affecting what goes on?
Well, I just shared one of my former students is with a major chain of home improvement stores and was here visiting campus last week, and he pointed out that the stores in Texas got caught without lawn trimmers, this entire chain. Now, they were on order, but everything happened so much earlier that there they were without, the stores weren't stocked. They didn't anticipate selling, lawn trimmers that early, and so if you were looking at this particular chain in Texas, you had a hard time finding a lawn trimmer.
Yeah.
Now, on the ag side, that hasn't been an issue. We haven't seen fertilizer shortages. A lot of that's pre-ordered, and the supplies are there. So,
right.
We knew we were going to need seed corn. It it was on hand in time to plant. It isn't something that we're not. Agriculture isn't quite the just-in-time inventory model that some of these retail stores are. So.
Yeah, but it's interesting, the expectations. I mean, the weekend before last, I was out at a home improvement center, and the weather was nice and everything was great. And I thought, why are there not more plants here for sale? And then I looked, and I my watch and the date is on it, and I realized, well, because it's so early in the year, there aren't any plants here. I mean, I think a lot of people may be having a hard time just remembering that this is so early in the year,
yeah.
Right? I mean, I have peonies blooming at the beginning of April now, and it's really interesting. Rob, are there any things that you've noticed related to the early spring in terms of what's going on down at the conservation department?
Well, as I said, we monitor the timing of development of various plants and so forth, and just seeing how much quicker things are, and looking at sort of the degree day accumulations across the state from north to south. In a typical year, of course, you know, it warms up earlier in the southern part of the state than the north. And then as you look at the accumulation of degree days across the state, there's sort of a big spread from north to south. This year, when we had those 90-degree days, and things just moved quickly across the whole state, so there's not as much of a difference between north and south. So and I've been hearing reports from people who have friends and relatives in Iowa and Minnesota, and some of the things that are happening up there. It's just amazing that it's all kind of come really quickly, and there's not as much of a variation across the north to south range.
Interesting. What are some of the things you're hearing are happening north of us?
Oh, I've talked to someone about, such and such a plant is blooming in Iowa, which they said it usually doesn't happen until, you know, late May or something like that. So it's just a variety of things.
Right. And what about things, you know, like invasive species that are slowly moving northward? I mean, is this facilitating that? Are there issues there that people are worried about?
Well, it certainly is beneficial to all kinds of things like that. The invasive species that I deal with are like the emerald ash borer, which attacks ash trees, and gypsy moth, which feeds on oaks and a variety of other things. It makes it difficult to monitor them and manage them because these are invasive species that threaten our forests or our natural resources. There's all kinds of monitoring that goes on, putting out various kinds of traps and various kinds of surveys where people are out looking for these. It makes it difficult to be out there and catch that spring emergence and so forth and try to watch for them. The main concern we have, of course, with a lot of these is populations are building to our east, in eastern and northern states, and we're concerned about how those things get transported here. A lot of them, a big way that they move is on firewood, and we're really concerned about the movement of firewood. You don't think about it when you have firewood, a few pieces of wood that you're going to take camping, but underneath the bark in the wood can be all kinds of these non-native pests, and so we really encourage people not to move firewood long distances, you know. Get the firewood near where you're going to burn it.
Interesting. And are there other things that go on to try to contain the spread of those things?
Well, the main thing is really outreach to let people know about this, make people more aware of them, but also where they occur, where they have been found. There are quarantines in place, state and federal quarantines. For example, with the emerald ash borer, there's quarantine against moving not only firewood, but any kind of ash tree or ash nursery stock or any kind of green wood. In Missouri, the only place where we have that quarantine right now is in Wayne County in the southeast part of the state. There are these kinds of things for all of these pests around the country.
Mm-hmm. And are there any kind of threats like that to the agricultural landscape in the state, or are we okay there?
Well, the comment Lowell made earlier about in the past, years ago, we treated everything, whether there was a problem or not, and the management techniques are so much improved now that the scouting, we apply when needed rather than, blanket treatments. So when they crop up, we do have remedies in place.
Right. Okay. That's going to be pretty much the time that we have for today, unfortunately. I'd like to thank our guest today, Tony Lupo, Chair of the University of Missouri Department of Soil, Environmental, and Atmospheric Sciences, Janice Stillman, Editor of the Old Farmer's Almanac, Rob Lawrence, a forest entomologist with the Missouri Department of Conservation, Michael Monson, Chair of MU's Department of Agricultural and Applied Economics, and Lowell Shostek, Northeast Missouri farmer. We'd like to remind you that Intersection takes place live for a full hour from 2 to 3 every Monday. You can join us each Monday afternoon by listening to KBIA or going online to kbia.org and following the link for Intersection. There you'll be able to watch a video feed of our program, submit your questions and comments, and participate in an online chat with others in the audience. You'll also find a video archive of all of our past programs, including the full hour of today's conversation. Intersection is broadcast from the Reynolds Journalism Institute and is a project of RJI and KBIA. Today's program was produced by Raymond Tungekar and Leanne Butkovic. Travis McMillan is our technical director with production assistance from Leah Becerra. Pat Akers is our audio producer. I'm Ruben Stern. Thanks for joining us. Have a great week.
The episode of Intersection that you just heard was originally taped on April 12th, 2012.